So we're here with Peter Singer, one of the co-authors of a new novel out called Ghost Fleet. Thanks for joining us, Peter. I think I want to start off with a question that's kind of themed throughout the new novel, is that the idea of the fog of war. So while the fog of war can never truly be lifted, it certainly seems that modern networked and connected militaries are sort of slowly working to peel it back to a certain extent. So in Ghost Fleet, I wonder, you depict situations where these new network sensors are disrupted or they fail, essentially. Are our militaries becoming too confident or reliant on these sort of new capabilities?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I think it's an important question in a number of ways. And the book, again, plays as a novel, but it also plays in, you know, real world in terms of the questions that are being raised right now. It's like a Tom Clancy book, but with 400 footnotes. And so within the conflicts of today, a common complaint from people in the military is the just massive flood of information that it's hard to sift through. They'll describe it that it's like sipping from a fire hose. That's true, and that is something that you could imagine in a conflict against a state power, but also you could imagine the spigot being turned off in a way that we haven't seen a Taliban or an ISIS be able to do. The idea of going after command and control networks, the idea of knocking down satellites, blocking access to GPS. And so it's putting false information. So not knocking down GPS, but one of the scenes in the book is an F-35 pilot who's flying over Oahu, and the system's telling him he's over Maui. And he's, you know, thinking to himself, I know damn well I'm not over Maui. And that's that, you know, when can you trust the technology? And again, it's the scenario of a great power war, but we already see these sorts of things playing out right now, even in our own experience of what information can you trust from the internet or not, whether it's someone trying to hack you by sending an email that seems like it's from you, but it's really from someone else, to the information on whether Russia did or did not, they did, involved in the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner. So you have that phenomena of what does it mean to have imperfect information. A parallel in this is that a really kind reviewer described it as the first cyberpunk war novel. And by that, what they were talking about is that you have different kinds of science fiction that have been mirrored in how we talk about the military. So you have kind of the Star Trek science fiction where all the technology works and it's perfect. And that was the revolution in military affairs debate, the Rumsfelds of the world. I'm going to have such great technology, the fog of war will be lifted. In cyberpunk, which is, you know, things like William Gibson, you have super high technology, but you still have the grit, you still have the grime, you still have the human element. The technology doesn't always work. And I think that's what we need to acknowledge is playing out in war. It's not that technology doesn't matter, which has been a pushback that we've seen some. It's technology's real, and we have, you know, these amazing science fiction-like technologies of drones becoming ever more autonomous, to electromagnetic railguns, to cyber warfare. But oh, by the way, you still have people using IEDs. You still have people using knives. You also have high-tech ways of going after high technology that takes you back to a pre-digital age. So a conflict with a Russia or a China, you know, we would have our, you know, cruise missiles and drones and F-35s, but we would also have an experience, as one Marine put it, be like pre-digital battles. And he was talking about, you know, kind of the battles of World War II and World War I, where first you had to find the enemy. You know, you had to find where you were. That's not been as much, you know, the post-digital experience, but it kind of take you back in time.
I guess there's this other theme as well about sort of these high technologies that then, and I think you've sort of alluded to this before, but then can be misused. They're put out there, and then they're misused. You know, Stuxnet is an interesting example of these sort of cyber programs or attack programs that are released and then perhaps repackaged and then used in different ways. Is that something we could possibly see more and more of?
That's the NSA calling to say, why are you talking yeah. about Stuxnet? It's the idea that there are a variety of technologies that we in the U.S. and Australia and other Western powers, it's been baked into our assumptions that either we would be the only ones with that particular class of technology, or we would be a generation ahead of the other side with whatever the technology was. That's you know, at the center of our defense planning going back to the Cold War. It was how we, you know, everything from how we were going to fight the Soviets and deter them, even though we had militaries much smaller, we'd have better gear, to, you know, the invasion of Iraq, where we invade with a force that's, you know, smaller than the force we're going against, even though traditionally in war, you know, the defender had the advantage. That won't be the case moving forward for a couple of reasons. One is cyber threats. So a lot of our most sophisticated gear, the other side has hacked and is replicating it. Joint Strike Fighter, J-31, Google them and you will go, wow, they look really the same,
yeah.
except one has a star on it. Maybe the innards.
Painted black as well.
Yeah, sure. Maybe the innards are different. But the point is you have the complications of it's hard to win an arms race when you're paying for the R&D for the other side. But it's also not just copying of gear. It's, you know, working in cutting edge fields. China, for example, doing amazing work in everything from supercomputers to genomics to hypersonics. They've carried out more hypersonics tests than the U.S. military has. So that applies to states. There's another phenomenon that applies to both state and non-state actors, which is some of the most exciting things are happening on the civilian sector. You know, it used to be the military would lead in something and then the civilian side would get it. Now the military is having a hard time keeping up. And that's where, whether it's a China with an openness to technology in the way the Soviet Union didn't have, or, you know, a non-state actor like an ISIS, where, you know, they have access to, they're doing better at Twitter than people in our bureaucracy who can't even get authorized to get the Twitter account. Right. So this is this phenomena that I'm not sure we've adjusted our understanding of not only the way the world will be, but how it already is right now. And that's what's been fun, is using the novel, which is fiction, to actually make points about things that are already here today.
Well, actually, talking about the civilian side leads me into my next question. In the novel, you kind of play around with the idea of what role global technology and internet companies would take on if there was any major, say, conventional conflict between, you know, the United States and China. Do you think these companies would act differently in comparison to conflicts in the past? And have these corporations taken on sort of global identities that would see them less likely to take national sides?
Yeah, so one of the... well, actually, there's two really fun storylines in the book. And one plays, as you hit it, this idea of something that, you know, we didn't have back in World War II, where World War II, and again, this is still our assumptions of the way things work. Essentially, the government, you know, in the U.S. turns to Detroit, and it becomes the arsenal of democracy. You know, Ford shifts from making cars to it's pumping out, you know, one factory, a B-24 bomber every hour. And the same thing happened in Australia and the like. We're seeing, you know, again, this, you don't wait for the what if of the war. We're seeing the Pentagon in the U.S., for example, reach out to Silicon Valley right now. But Silicon Valley's reacting very differently. One, it looks at the Pentagon as this artifact still of, you know, it's a place designed and operated along the rules of 1947. And
it's slow.
It's slow. Yeah. It's ungainly. It avoids risk. Unwilling to wrestle with, you know, disruption, all the kind of buzzwords and ideals that Silicon Valley, you know, exists on, and not just Silicon Valley, but technology companies all around the world. But then there's a second thing, which is there are companies that have a global everything from identity to global business to where they park their profits and the like. So one of the fun scenes in the book is not a Silicon Valley company. It's a retail company, Walmart, at a shareholder meeting where they're essentially having the debate over, do we go with where our founder is from? Do we go with where our corporate headquarters is located physically? Do we go with where we do most of our business? Do we go with where our shareholders are and where they say we should go? Multinational corporations, these are, you know, they have these. And so the point, though, is that that's the fiction of the book, and it's a fun scene. In reality, we already saw that play out in the Snowden affair, where a number of companies, for example, from Silicon Valley, wrestled with this exact same, you know, are we an American company? No, we're a global company. Oh, no, we're a European company. And so they were all, and they came down on it in different ways than maybe they might if it was, you know, truly a state-on-state conflict. Another difference of the global identity and business than back in World War II is one, we've got this new class of we think of them as empowered individuals. In our world, we talk about them as, you know, empowered individuals, terrorists. There's also another kind that are out there that are billionaires. And by that, you know, I don't mean, you know, that there's a positive and negative side of this. And, you know, we're seeing in the, you know, billionaires that are utterly disrupting the way both business happens, to how sports happens, to how media happens, to how aerospace happens. A number of these billionaires are utterly fascinated with, you know, space, and they're changing all the rules.
Right.
And so we play with, well, what's one of these guys going to do if there's a war? Another economic shift. And it's not just they're billionaires with kind of loose state identities.
Yeah, personalities.
You know, are they Australian? Are they British? Are they, you know, are they global? Another difference with the 1940s is the rise. Back then it was companies, well, if they were linked to war, they made the goods of war. They made the weapons. Well, now we have the rise of something I've written a nonfiction book on, which is private military contractors. Mm. I don't make the weapons for you. I'm a service provider. I provide you the bodies, the people, the soldiers. Well, we've grown accustomed to them fighting in the small wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. Do we think they're going to sit out the big wars? They're not going to play a role?
Mm.
What's the role they're going to play? And, you know, we have a little bit of fun with that in the storyline.
I think it's a particularly interesting question because considering the talent competition between kind of governments and global technology corporations, where some of the best talent in these cyber activities or whatever might actually be in Silicon Valley. And so when push comes to shove and there's a conventional conflict, you know, what will the government, you know, be pressured?
There's everything from, you know, how to, in the US, we haven't had a draft in place since essentially 1973, to the government's relationship with business. Is where you put on our walk hats, but it's fun because it plays a role in the book. Is there's actually an old law on the books that most people aren't aware of that's still a law. And it basically gives our government power in a national emergency, essentially to tell corporations what to do and everything from what they make to how they're going to price things. Mm-hmm. Now, we would go to, what? That sounds horrifying.
Yeah.
It's still on the books. Would that be something that would play a role? To, just how people view themselves. If there's a national crisis, will you think about service in a different way? And this is, of course, is not just, you know, individuals, but how generations might wrestle differently with it. So, you know, the book title Ghost Fleet is, it's the nickname of the real world National Defense Reserve Fleet. These are the real U.S. Navy ships that are kept in reserve, the old ships, the old retired ships, kept in reserve just in case. And so it plays with the idea of, you know, what if you brought back these old ships? And you and I were talking about, you know, there's a parallel with Battlestar Galactica of weirdly, some of the old ships might fare better than some of the newer things because they won't have as many of the suspect technologies in them. But it also hits another thing, which is the different generations of the people who would play a role. One of the newer ships that appears in the book is the USS Zumwalt, which is no other way to describe it. It's a stealth battleship that is under construction right now in Maine. It will be deployed to the Pacific. It will be out here in a couple of years. Real ship. The shipyard where it's being built has both software programmers, because the ship is powered by over 4 million lines of Linux code, but also the last generation of welders working in the same. And so again, you know, we have fun with that in the book of that kind of culture clash, but it's mirrored in reality.
And needing both generations to really...
And that's the, you know, if there's the takeaway lesson. It's that whoever can blend the old and the new technology, blend the new highly disruptive ideas with the old tried and true lessons of war, that's going to be who wins out.
Well, it's a great book, Peter, and thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.